March. The UN says Israeli forces may have committed war crimes and crimes against humanity by targeting protesters in Gaza with lethal force during this year, including children, journalists, and the disabled. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Has an immediate job opening, full-time junior systems administrator here in New York. Details at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Dark, Dina Geisler, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Challenging the Both Sides Narrative, Difference Between Fascist and Antifa Movements in the Trump Era, on Thursday, April 4th from 7 to 9 p.m. at Cider Riot in Portland. Challenging the Both Sides Narrative is a talk by Dr. Stanislav Vysotsky. This talk will provide an overview of contemporary fascist and anti-fascist movements with a focus on the key differences between them. Again, that's Challenging the Both Sides Narrative, Difference Between Fascist and Antifa Movements in the Trump Era, on Thursday, April 4th from 7 to 9 p.m. at Cider Riot, 807 Northeast Cooch Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Zenith's Tar Sands Oil Expansion Community Forum on Friday, April 5th, from 6:30 to 9 p.m. at the City of Portland Water Pollution Control Laboratory in Portland. Second in a series of community forums on Zenith Energy's Tar Sands Oil Export Expansion, this event will supply project background, climate justice impacts, health and safety risks, and ideas for public action around Zenith's oil terminal. A variety of perspectives will be presented. Again, that's the Zenith's Tar Sands Oil Expansion Community Forum on Friday, April 5th, from 6:30 to 9 p.m. at the City of Portland Water Pollution Control Laboratory, 6543 North Burlington Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And you're listening to KBOO Portland. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from the Oregon Symphony Concert Series for the Community, Saturday, April 13th, celebrating music of the Americas with music from North, Central, and South America, featuring performances by Hillsborough's Marishi Una Voss. For more information, go to orsymphony.org. And more talk radio is up next.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You are listening to More Talk Radio on KBOO, your community radio station, 90.7 in Portland, 91.9 in Hood River, 104.3 in Corvallis in Albany, and 90 KBOO.FM.
Yes. Your talk radio, our talk radio, more talk radio.
And today is
April
Monday,
Fool's Day.
April 1.
Yeah.
Okay.
But we don't have a joke, do we?
Well, you know, we could talk about
money and politics.
And money and politics. That's joke enough.
That is a joke enough.
We have the opportunity this morning to talk with an author, Chris Layman, of he wrote the book The Money Cult, subtitle Capitalism, Christianity, and the Unmasking of the American Dream. It's a fascinating volume, and maybe
it's a scholarly volume.
Yeah, maybe Max Weber would appreciate it. I don't know.
Did you chuckle there, Chris?
yeah. I'm it's not often I get called scholarly these days.
Well, this is an in-depth book. You put some life into this book. I'm almost overwhelmed with all of the information and facts. But first, let's just introduce you. Co-editor
sure.
of Book Forum, senior editor and columnist for The Baffler, and columnist for In These Times, and you've written for a host of others, from Harper's Magazine to The Washington Post to The Nation. And
actually, I hate to jump in and correct right off the bat, but
hey, that, please do.
my author's bio is almost entirely obsolete now.
Oh, okay.
I don't do any of those things anymore. Just as of, I think it's official as of today, I am editing the New Republic.
Oh, okay. Well, congratulations.
Former editor of The Baffler now, regrettably, because I love The Baffler dearly and want all your listeners to subscribe to that. But yeah, I have a new gig.
Wow, the New Republic.
A new gig.
Yeah, I know. Weird, right?
No, good. So, having had our introduction corrected now, we can launch in. And
right.
I wanted to first get an idea of what motivated you to write this book and to write it in the depth that you've written it, because this is no glossing over by any means.
You know, the sort of immediate backstory to the book is it's kind of the dissertation I never wrote. I dropped out of graduate school long ago, and I've always been fascinated by American religion and its many peculiar twists and turns across the years, and the relationship between, you know, what it, you know, I think anyone following the American political scene can acknowledge that it's one of the most powerful motivations of political behavior in our country today. And how, you know, what began as kind of a social gospel, you know, Puritan era conception of how Christian believers should, you know, offer material support for each other, became a sort of open celebration of laissez-faire capitalism over time, and the many strange, you know, figures and intellectual movements involved in that transformation. So it's, you know, it's, yeah, you're right. It's sort of been a lifelong obsession of mine, and I was grateful to have the opportunity to sit down and write about it.
Chris, full disclosure here, I for the last 30-something years, I've been an ordained minister in the United Church of Christ, and that's my my daytime and
nighttime
gig. So I was fascinated by your book and your ability to clarify, I think, some understanding and clarify some misconceptions of the development of the American experiment and the relationship to religion. And one thing I think you do very, very well in this is clearly show how religion has informed the development of the American experiment, and more particularly help us to understand how how religion has developed, but also in terms of the relationship with money and how money has been sanctified in religion, unlike, you know, our European siblings, religion has had a different development in the United States.
That's absolutely right. I think you know, there's been a, as you know, you know, the UCC you know, has its own denominational origins in the United States, and we have, you know, I often say that I don't know what that was. I don't often say that. I do often say that American religion is the first deregulated industry in our country. And by that I mean, you know, in 1820, the Massachusetts legislature overturned the first state-sponsored church, or the last, state-established church in the United States. And at that point, you know, there was a frenetic and, you know, fascinating, to my mind, free market force unleashed in religious thought, where no one could sort of claim what you had described as sort of the European model of a state-sponsored official faith that, you know, collects taxes and acts in many ways as an extension of government. So in the American system, you have this kind of denominational free-for-all where all kinds of figures emerge as, you know, founders of new religions, prophets seeking to revive old versions of faith, and money is an essential part of all of that. As the consolidation of a national market economy occurs in the 19th century, you see a very, to my mind, very clear corresponding explosion of new religions and new beliefs to sort of sort out national identity amid these radically transformed conditions. I think the rise of Mormonism is kind of a big sub-theme in the book. Yes. And I think Joseph Smith's, you know, discovery not merely of a new kind of a new world brand of Christian faith, but a very money-conscious brand that, you know, the Mormon Church, I think, is perhaps still the only American religion that founded its own bank. It had a land bank in Kirtland, Ohio, when the Mormons were sojourning west. And obviously, the commercial empire founded under Brigham Young's stewardship in Utah bears dramatic testimony to the twin forces of, again, market capitalism and sort of self-made religious belief in America. And, you know, fast forward into our own age, there's been, you know, no end of think pieces and speculations in the Trump era about why do these evangelicals, who are so conservative on so many cultural matters, you know, why do they stand for this adulterer, a, you know, thrice divorced, you know, lying autocrat.
Lying, cheating autocrat.
As, yeah, exactly. As, you know, not only the head of state, but in many evangelical circles, a Bible-anointed deliverer of their movement.
And one way, which might be difficult for people to understand, you know, the anointing of Donald Trump by this, say, word of faith, Pentecostalism.
Right.
Evangelical.
As opposed to, you know, the old line, mainstream, dying Protestantism. There's something new happening in American religion.
Right.
Well, is it new? With the rise of Donald Trump.
In some way, you know, American religion is always new, I would argue. It's very restlessly self reinventing. But there, you know, there is a distinctive strain. You mentioned the word of faith, Pentecostal tradition, and it's, you know, sort of the grandfather of the modern prosperity gospel was Norman Vincent Peale, who was Donald Trump's minister when Trump was growing up. And Trump very widely cites Peale as an important intellectual and spiritual influence. Now, I know, you know, a lot of what Trump has said about his own religious belief system is a lie.
Yes.
But this is true. I mean, Peale actually presided over Trump's first wedding and was, you know, very close to Trump's father and embodied a fiercely anti-New Deal reactionary devotion to capitalism, which, you know, his best-known book, The Power of Positive Thinking, he actually wrote while he was on a union-busting junket to Hawaii, which is another, you know, one of these fascinating factoids in American religious history. You don't, you know, think of ministers as, you know,
union busters
out there trying to break what is, in fact, a kind of, you know, socially-minded spiritual solidarity. But that is modern Protestantism to a tremendous degree. And Peale, you know, didn't come directly out of the Pentecostal word of faith tradition. He was a weird sort of Dutch Reformed outlier. Mm-hmm. But everyone he was sort of in cahoots with on the American religious right in the first flush of the Cold War was, you know, four square, so to speak, in that tradition.
I wanted to establish something right before we get into what is closer to modern history. And this was on the very first page of your first chapter, The Founding Faith. And you mentioned, as strange as it may seem to anyone, reversed in the money nostrums of today's Protestant scene, the worship of wealth didn't come naturally to the first European settlers. They were more of a cooperative commonwealth, you said, which almost makes it sound like that dreaded word called socialism.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's long before, you know, Karl Marx was a gleam in his parents' eye, but it obviously has to be greatly caveated
right.
in the sense that, first of all, they're, you know, everyone who was a Puritan who was in the settling generation in the New World, they were not social democrats. You know, they if you were not part of the elect and not saved, you had very little social standing, certainly nothing approaching equality. But for people within the faith, you know, John Winthrop's famous City on the Hill sermon, which is usually cited as a, you know, landmark announcement of American exceptionalism, that will be a city on the hill for other nations, and, you know, the risk is to become a byword if you fail. But yeah, Winthrop was very explicit about how the Puritan settlers, in the event of any sort of emergency, of which there were, of course, many,
yes,
were spiritually obliged to share their property. And that's all comes out of the kind of body of Christ's vision of what the church is. You know, there is no member in the body of Christ that is, you know, a superior part of that body. So in a time of crisis especially, yes, it is a first order mandate to care for anyone, you know, experiencing privation or want or disease or facing an emergency.
You are listening.
The story of the book, in many ways, is how we got from there to Joel Osteen and Donald Trump. To my mind, it's an amazingly interesting and fascinating tale, because I don't take the position that many people do, that, you know, the apostles of the money cults are, you know, kind of frauds. They're not Elmer Gantry type hustlers. I think they really are sincere in their beliefs for the most part. And, to me, the fascination is how does someone come to a sincerely held set of beliefs that are I think we can say socially destructive and spiritually suspect, but seem internally consistent. And that is sort of the story. There are, you know, several key themes running through American religious history that enable this. I think the idea of the primitive church, that is something that exists apart from all prior institutional forms of belief, lends itself, and it's a key, you know, the Puritans have this faith, and it runs throughout all modern American religious history. It is a way of, to use a financial metaphor, it's kind of the equivalent of a leveraged buyout strategy. You're going to strip the property you take over of its assets and start over and consolidate it into something bigger, which happens again and again. I mentioned Mormonism, and that began also as a quasi-socialist poor people's movement in the burned over district of New York, and evolves over time and amid a great deal of hardship into a, you know, sort of de facto worship of free market capitalism. And the same is true of Pentecostalism, which was predominantly African American and took root among dispossessed farmers and rural migrants in Los Angeles, and then becomes a word of faith gospel, and becomes, you know, very explicitly, you know, you pray for material reward. That is what seed faith is, and that is what Oral Roberts preached, and Joel Osteen, who is the most influential preacher in today's America, preaches routinely, that you, God is there to make you prosper.
To make you prosper.
and it sets up, you know, for the old Puritan faith, it sets up a pretty insoluble paradox, because if God is rewarding those who prosper, the Donald Trumps and the Bill Gateses of the world, then he must be punishing those who don't, right?
Well, that would be the conclusion.
Right, and that is why you have, you know, the perverse spectacle of Trump, you know, tax cut that punishes, you know, the middle class and anyone below the middle class, and yet he is held forth again as a Christian figure of deliverance.
Okay, hold on just a second here. You're listening to More Talk Radio here on KBOO Portland, and we invite your calls. The number is 503-231-8187. We're speaking today with Chris Lehman, who is the author of The Money Cult, Capitalism, Christianity, and the Unmaking of the American Dream. And by all means, call early so that you get your chance to speak to the author. So you've mentioned a lot about how politics kind of got mixed into the bag because there was the idea that, well, there's money to be made, and there are people like Ben Franklin who... who became a figurehead, I guess, in a way, of being a shrewd businessman and kind of some personality that wooed people into this incongruent, dissonance, this kind of cognitive dissonance.
And Franklin is...
Yes.
Ben Franklin is sort of, you know, the ideal type that Max Weber singles out is, you know, he embodies the spirit of American capitalism, you know, once the Protestant ethic is unleashed, and, you know, is, in Weber's telling, largely a secularized figure. I, you know, had a slightly different interpretation of Franklin, because Franklin was a big champion of George Whitefield, who was the first great revivalist preacher in the United States, and wanted to found a model school and a settlement of, you know, embodying Christian capitalist values on what was then the frontier in Ohio. So I think this is another thing about, just as, you know, American religion is more inflected with capitalist values than, you know, one might otherwise assume, American capitalism is steeped in spiritual ideas to a remarkable degree. You see, you know, sort of quasi-spiritual rhetoric coming out of the Silicon Valley tech world all the time. Talk of, you know, the singularity, the great messianic moment that's going to transform humanity into a higher brand of thinking machine. Or, you know, even the cult of innovation, which is held to be this, a charismatic property that every, entrepreneur in the tech world has to possess.
But let's see if we can delve a little bit more into that in terms of how you mentioned Silicon Valley and the rise there. One, it's clear, you know, for the last couple of generations, the so-called decline in terms of membership in terms of American religious institutions. At the same time, continue, people who don't want any involvement in institutional religion talks about being spiritual but not religious, and have this
The nuns, as they're called.
Yeah, nuns, and this semi, I don't know what you want to call it, spirituality. Is that differ, or how does that connect with the Joel Osteen type of prosperity gospel?
There is a great deal of overlap, both in form and content, I think. I think, you know, the kind of mindfulness movement, which has captivated corporate America, is a softer, you know, more liberal version of, you know, Joel Osteen lays out in remarkable detail, like, you know, if you want to succeed and prosper, Joel Osteen says, you have to stand up straight. You have to, you know, make sure your car is clean. He has this very, it's actually is a lot like Benjamin Franklin, who, you know, in Poor Richard's Almanac, had early to bed, early to rise. All of these kind of maxims and aphorisms about how to succeed. And I think the mindfulness movement, as it connects up to corporate America, is doing something very similar. It's trying to create a vision of the ideal self that is spiritually imbued and is geared toward making the believer, you know, prosper within this culture of venture capital. I think if anyone has seen the Netflix documentary about Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos, I mean, there's a fraud, first of all.
Oh, yeah.
No doubt. And, but, you know, there was a cult of personality around her, and I would argue just more broadly, a cult. You know, there was this idea that she was going to make something happen that was clearly not possible. And she did it by sort of adopting all the trappings and, you know, relics of Silicon Valley success. She dressed like Steve Jobs, and she, you know, gave these same kind of quasi-revival, you know, product rollouts that captivated, you know, Henry Kissinger and George Shultz and all the most, some of the most powerful white guys in America. So again, if you are making the case that, you know, whatever, secular rationalism dominates American capitalism and it's the best of all possible worlds on the model of Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, all you have to do is point to Elizabeth Holmes. You know, something else is going on there, and I argue it has a lot to do with our religious heritage.
You're listening to More Talk Radio here on KBOO Portland. The phone number is 503-231-8187. Join us in the conversation. We're speaking with Chris Lehman, who is the author of The Money Cult. And we'll go to Cody, who is waiting. Good morning, Cody.
Good morning, Susan.
So what's on your mind?
I'd like to ask your guest a question about the connection between religion, liability, the internet, and the connection of many of our American religions, specifically being having their policies exposed as to
what
the liability. And when I mean liability, I mean, you know how like some people start businesses and they start corporations or LLCs, and how right. if anything was wrong, the corporation or the LLCs will limit that liability, and how it directly right. connects to many of these religions. Like, there are some religions that are under the impression that we call them religions, but if we look closely, they're incorporated and they're publishing companies.
Right.
And a lot of people operate with them with the auspices as though there are religions, and when something really goes wrong, let's say if there's some type of molestation or if there's some right. type of deal going wrong, the lawyers come out. And
no,
all
it's
of
true. I mean, you know, I think, yeah, there's a reluctance to think of organized religions as institutions that have liability and you know, ideally accountability within the broader culture. And I do think, you know, there are lots of, you know, for instance, no one can estimate the assets held by the Mormon Church because it's a religion, but it's, you know, conservatively in the billions. They own massive tracts of land in South and Central America. You know, the right across from the main temple in Salt Lake City, they have their own, I'm not making this up, shopping mall. mm-hmm. That's, you know. So, yeah, I mean, I think there is a promiscuous, and this, again, is part of the American story, a promiscuous mingling of commercial expansion and religious faith. Toward well, the question of liability, per se, I don't really honestly well, know enough, except
I'll say liability specifically because there are many people who are coming over the internet and they're comparing stories.
Right.
And they're saying, right. well, did this preacher do this to you? Oh, well, he did this. And before you know it, instead of the religions who claim to be spiritual, the scaffolding, the Alan Watts, referred to religion as, and instead of right. the religion saying, oh, we're sorry, let's make this right, it all
no,
gets,
I mean, obviously,
part of the policy is to basically keep corruption in the majority of all the churches, including the New American ones, secret.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, now that is.
Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, that is a striking phenomenon, and you see it, you know, in the constant, you know, there are these sex scandals not only involving, you know, pedophilia, but, you know, the more run-of-the-mill Jim Baker, and what's his name, the Pentecostal guy who was Jerry Lee Lewis's
not Oral Roberts, but Jerry Falwell.
No,
not Falwell.
Not Oral Roberts.
I'm blanking on his.
I am too.
I'm blanking on his name.
Actually,
Falwell took over his ministry.
Jim and Tammy Baker.
No. They had their own.
They are.
Okay. It doesn't matter.
We know.
You know, Jim and Tammy Baker are another amazing case in point because, you know, they sponsored all these condo developments mm-hmm. where they had believers go to their theme park and purchase. And it turned out to be largely fraudulent, and they had to do a massive out-of-court settlement. And
right.
I'm sure certainly part of the come-on, I don't know about the corporate structure, but, you know, the idea was, you know, you could have a permanent place in Jim and Tammy's, you know, paradise land or whatever it was called. And, yeah, it was all a financial scam. It is very hard, you know, because even though religions are, as I was saying earlier, a deregulated business, there is, you know, they're tax exempt. So, you know, there are efforts to sort of increase accountability on the part of nonprofit and tax-exempt bodies, but religions are very powerful.
I have one final question, and I can talk to that. And it's pertaining to how the internet, and I noticed you made a direct connection to Donald Trump and evangelicals taking in about Donald Trump,
right.
And whether or not Donald Trump is like what if is like what Michael Moore compared him to, a Mazel Tov cocktail thrown at Washington D.C. as a result
right.
of the level of corruption that people have had to endure by many of these institutions, especially religion. And I'll take the rest of your commentary off the air. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for your call,
okay.
Cody.
Thank you. I think it is, you know, I mean, it's complicated. The evangelical piece of Trump support, which those are some of the strongest Trump supporters, and I think, you know, they did get something very direct from Trump's election, which is to say to conservative Supreme Court justices, and that is what a great deal of the sort of real politic organizing on the evangelical right has been focused on for decades.
Mm-hmm.
But they also, you know, they do see Trump as a transformative, charismatic figure who's not quite religious, but maybe a vessel of God in their view.
So
they will say, you know, King David, of course, was an adulterer, and he was okay by God. So why not Donald Trump?
So talking about this transformation of the evangelical participation in the American political scene, saying from Jimmy Carter, more specifically Ronald Reagan and the rise of Jerry Falwell and all. And at one time, I remember when the controversy over Ronald Reagan, because he was divorced, and should
mm-hmm.
evangelicals
right.
support him. And then you had like the perfect evangelical candidate, George Bush Jr., the
right.
the second one. So what did evangelicals see wrong with sticking with someone that is clearly an evangelical in terms of theology, and going to Donald Trump, who is the embodiment of this New York
huckster?
Right.
Huckster. Yeah. What happened in those?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think you mentioned Jimmy Carter, who was the first modern evangelical president. He was born again and. In 1976, there was, you know, a pretty significant evangelical turnout for Carter. It completely shifted in 1980 with the rise of the religious right behind Reagan. And, you know, you can think of Reagan as sort of a, you know, he was definitely more religious than Trump, but not, mm-hmm. you know, I don't think
he was a
by
movie
any
star,
stretch of the imagination. He
could morph.
Yeah, and he wasn't, you know... as he said to the Southern Baptist Convention in the 1980 cycle, like, you can't endorse me, but I can endorse you.
Mm-hmm.
so he had a very, and you know, the main thing that happened during that time was the massive mobilization of opposition to the Roe decision. It's yeah. interesting, when Roe was first handed down, the Southern Baptists, voted.
Choice.
Yeah, they endorsed the decision. They issued a public statement. So there was this massive turnaround in the evangelical world. It used to be that opposing abortion was mainly a Catholic issue. And it's interesting because one of the key characters who brought that crusade to the evangelical world in America was this guy Francis Schaeffer, who wrote this very influential tract called How Shall We Then Live?
Mm-hmm.
And it's all about, you know, what today I think it would be called the liberal culture of death, and, you know, the way that various intellectuals and artists fell in thrall to a, you know, kind of pagan slash satanic derogation of the sanctity of life. But what's interesting about that book, for my book, is that... Schaefer goes out of his way to castigate the materialism and, you know, sort of empty worship of success in American life broadly and in American religious, you know, figures specifically. And none of that caught on, obviously. Everyone got the abortion message loud and clear, and it revolutionized a generation of religious politics. But the idea that American religion was too materialistic and imbued with, again, pagan spirits of wealth worship was completely not on the table. And it's sort of an epilogue to all that is Francis Schaeffer's son has written a series of memoirs, and it's a bitter critic of the evangelical right.
Yeah,
and he claims that Schaeffer himself, just before his death, also referred to these people as, you know, untrustworthy people. So,
yes, it's sort of like the son rebelling against his father, Frankie Schaeffer.
Yeah, no, there are many stories in the Bible and elsewhere about that. But yeah, to your larger points, you know, I do argue and believe firmly that what melds the evangelical base of support to Trump in a much more visceral way is the gospel of prosperity. They see Donald Trump, not without reason, as, you know, the embodiment of the American success ethic. An early critic of Trump somewhere said that he is a poor person's idea of a rich person. Mm-hmm. And I do think that is how he's able to position himself as, you know, the tribune of the working class. He's going to revive all these deindustrializing communities and dying company towns. He doesn't care about any of that.
No, he doesn't.
But he's able to. No, I mean, his policies are pointed 180 degrees in the opposite
totally
direction.
Totally an antithesis, yes. So,
right, but he is able to connect with them in this deeper spiritual way. He embodies the kind of success they identify with, and they identify with it because they've been told in their churches that to be a good Christian believer is to be a successful capitalist.
And we hear that again and again.
Just go to any Joel Osteen, turn on the TV and watch a Joel Osteen sermon. It is... You know, he never studied theology, but he was a communications major at Oral Roberts University.
I was about to say he must have studied communication. You're listening to More Talk Radio here on Your Community Connection, KBOO Portland. Phone number 503-231-8187. Don't be shy. Call up, ask questions. And we are speaking with the author of The Money Cult, Capitalism, Christianity, and the Unmaking of the American Dream, Chris Layman. I have a question here about what I'll call, and you mentioned it once before, kind of a new version of the secular prosperity gospel. A secular version of the prosperity gospel,
right.
And that's this mindfulness and life hacking culture that
right.
Silicon Valley has creaked up. Mm-hmm. Now, with some of the falls of technology, some of the rises of elements of technology like Bitcoin, does the formula for money still equals success bear a strong current still or
oh,
currency
yes.
or
no,
currency?
It's, you know, it's a very, you know, Silicon Valley is awash in all kinds of, you know, harebrained ideas in my view, but a lot of the, you know, the lead exponents of success in Silicon Valley are diehard libertarians. And, you know,
yes.
Peter Thiel, who was a key co-founder of eBay and a key Trump advisor, is a Bitcoin investor. He sort of, you know, embodies it all. He wants to found seasteading communities, which are these, you know, people who don't want to live under any kind of government can go to neutral international waters and live on a boat. He also has bought a property in New Zealand for, you know, whatever sort of dire apocalyptic scenario lays in wait in his mind. You know, that in his mind it would be, you know, socialism or the government, you know, taking a few more million dollars from him. And, you know, if you look at all of those allegiances in a structural way, they're religious. They're, you know, he is not personally religious, but I, you know, preparing for the end times, it goes, as you know, way back, you know, to the original primitive church. And, you know, this idea that you can found a utopian community outside of society is not that different from what the apostles tried. You know, this is all, you know, again, you have to think, I think we are so accustomed to demarcating the spiritual realm from secular life and the conduct of business and politics that we miss a lot of these deeper structural connections. And yeah, Silicon Valley is full of that kind of messianic talk, you know, and it's interesting now because, you know, anyone who's old like me remembers the 90s when everyone, you know, all the champions of technology were saying, you know, this is going to democratize everything. Yes. You know, you'll be able to directly interface with your representatives in Congress, and you'll be able to organize massive online petitions and things like the Coiny Crusade, and all of this, you know, magical stuff was going to happen. Remember the Arab Springs, which were revolts we were told all started on Facebook, which was not true. but that whole, you know, Hillary Clinton, when she was Secretary of State, actually, you know, had a whole department devoted to promoting connectivity in, you know, authoritarian regimes. Now, on the other side of all that, we see Cambridge Analytica and Facebook, you know, being a delivery system for vicious right-wing propaganda and hate speech. And that's the world. It's not democracy, folks. But no. Because people were able to endow it with all these kind of mystic attributes, you know, there had to be something inherently leveling and democratic about being able to log on and engage in the public discourse. No one accounted for, you know, malicious people using the same technology. So that too, I think, is a kind of faith, you know, that was articulated cynically, because I don't think anyone, you'll never persuade me that Mark Zuckerberg has set out to make a more democratic world. But, you know, it got the job done, right?
So now we live, matter of speaking,
with these. Yeah, we live in an age of digital monopoly in which all information is now suspect. So thanks, guys. Liberation.
So I think in our morning dialogue that you've been able to outline the role of religion / spirituality and its connection to American economic system, and where we are today in terms of, I don't know, late stage capitalism or whatever you want to call it, and what you mentioned, you know, your reflections on Zuckerberg and modern capitalism, Silicon Valley. There's still, I don't know, is there still a link, a connection, or can we ever disconnect economic development from having some sort of religious anointing
Oh, sure. I mean, you're a minister. I mean, so you understand that, you know, many of the great reform crusades in American history all come directly out of religious activism. You know, the suffrage movement, the abolitionist movement, temperance, which is a two-sided thing, but actually did a lot of social good. And of course, the civil rights movement comes directly out of the Black Church. It's the greatest, you know, sort of moral crusade in contemporary American life. So obviously, you know, I wrote the book because I take religion seriously, and I understand that, you know, it can provide people with resources. I mean, the civil rights movement being a perfect example. If Martin Luther King and the other leaders of Black churches had followed strictly secular reasoning, there was no way they were going to win. Any kind of rational realpolitik analysis of the prospects ahead would say, well, okay, maybe you can chip away in the courts and gradually get things like the Brown decision on a better footing. But to get a, you know, second Reconstruction, a Civil Rights Act, Voting Rights Act, you know, end to at least, you know, legal segregation, you need faith for that. You need to believe in a higher order of justice than what the world proffers. So, yeah, I mean, I think, and we see it now in the Moral Mondays movement in North Carolina and other pockets of evangelical, you know, resistance, not capital R resistance, but so I think, you know, part of my motivation in writing the book is to, you know, get people to see that there is a choice here. You know, you can be a sort of member of an evangelical megachurch that falls in line with Trump and all Trump represents, or you can go back to, you know, some version of what John Winthrop was preaching, that we all have deep mutual obligation to help and serve each other and enact justice in the world, because, you know, going to happen on its own.
Mm-hmm. We'll go to caller Carl, line one. Hit it. Good morning, Carl.
Hey there.
Hi.
Hi. So, yeah, good to hear your conversation. And I was just thinking as you're speaking, and I kind of wrote this down so I could keep it straight. But what I was thinking was that I think these subjects reflect the basic misunderstanding that we have of ourselves, like we as humans have of ourselves, and that, you know, this, I think this misunderstanding is largely due to the unsophisticated worship of gods and the belief that our ultimate satisfaction has to be gotten from outside of ourselves, and so basically it makes us victims of these thoughts and rules and gods and ghosts that we imagine have something to do with us. And then the pursuit of wealth and money falls right into the same kind of mold of trying to get
right.
satisfaction from things from outside of ourselves.
Right, that are external.
Right. When I think the absolute truth of us as humans is that our greatest reward can truly only come from the simple loving and caring that we can give to ourselves, and we all have the ability to do that. We don't need to be wealthy or rich or follow the rules of some book that says, you know, how to live a life. And then
right.
And then my last thought is that I think I heard that St. Francis said something to the effect that what we are looking for is where we are looking from. And I think that is something that kind of puts all this stuff into context. So
thanks a lot.
Yeah, well, thank you. That is very well put. And I think, you know, the only caveat I might add is that I do, as I was just saying before, I do think, you know, there is a kind of religious faith that advances, you know, an ethic of loving care and justice, and it is recoverable. You know, there are, you know, spiritual books have value depending on what they say. So, but yes, otherwise, I completely, I think you've nicely distilled a lot of what I think on this subject.
Thank you, Carl.
Yes, thank you, Carl. We do have another caller online, but I wanted to add, well, in the place of transformation is where we find the Gnostic capitalist, I think, is what you mentioned, and I kind of
right.
smashed it together.
Wow, you have read the book. I'm impressed.
you know, and I wanted to talk about how they made that transformation from we have our happiness in who we make ourselves to be, how we help our neighbor, to we have our happiness and what we have accrued and who we can buy, you know. And I see that as also
right.
being a feature of this marriage or sanctification, I think is the word you use, of the market and finances.
Right. I do think, you know, there you know, as you noted at the outset of my book, there was a sense in which the worlds of enterprise and commercial activity and, you know, religious observance were morally counterposed, that you had to make a sacrifice, you had to live for something greater than yourself. Excuse me. And gradually that shifts, in part because, you know, Americans, as a famous historian argued, were a people of plenty. They saw material abundance. And the other piece of this that is relevant, I think, which stands a little in contrast to Max Weber's famous thesis about the Protestant ethic and the rise of capitalism, is America, you know, Max Weber was chiefly describing European economies in which labor was overabundant, and you had to sort of trick workers into working for bosses by creating a vision of salvation that involved, you know, strict adherence to work routines and the accumulation of wealth. In the American scene, there, you know, there was a shortage of labor. There was not this superabundance of labor. So you were telling workers something else. I mean, first of all, you were bringing in slaves and creating a feudal, racialized social order that is a big problem for Christianity, and eventually got, you know, at least in broad, you know, slavery was abolished. But more than that, you had a vision of, you know, labor that led not to so much to individual accumulation as, you know, extravagant, authentic self-expression in the marketplace. That's how you get, you know, Max Weber was basically talking about how you get a rural, you know, agricultural worker to go to a factory. In America, the dominant model was how you turn a factory worker into Andrew Carnegie or, you know, a robber baron or a mogul. There were no conceivable limits at a certain time in our economic development to how much wealth you could accrue, and religion kind of went all in with that. That's why you have the Spiritual Success Manual, which Dale Carnegie comes, Norman Vincent Peale, Dale Carnegie too. But that is a whole tradition pioneered by ministers. That this is something that, you know, people don't sufficiently appreciate. But, you know, the 19th century manuals of success were by, you know, ministers like Henry Ward Beecher and a bunch of post-Civil War people. There were spiritual biographies of presidents, holding them up as models of piety and wealth.
Well, let's see if we can get to this last caller here. John, you're on the line.
Sure.
Okay, I'll make an analogy like the Wizard of Oz, where, you know, the curtain was pulled back and it was just an ordinary man.
Yes.
Do you think that
right,
eventually that many people will start saying, hey, this is a big scam? Because, you know, like, our, you know, people have to work two jobs, many people, just to get by.
Yep.
And then you have, you know, the offering going around. We want 10%. We want 20. We want 25%.
Right.
If you can't come to our church with 25% of your gross income, then, you know, get out.
Okay, we have a about 30 seconds. Go
okay,
ahead,
that's
Chris.
It. Okay.
All right, thank you.
All right, well, it's funny you mentioned the Wizard of Oz, because I discuss it in the book. L. Frank Baum was a spiritualist who actually, the epilogue to the Wizard of Oz is that Dorothy moves to the Emerald City and is surrounded by luxury goods, and that's kind of L. Frank Baum's Gnostic spiritual vision of capitalism. In other words, I do think, you know, the curtain gets pulled away, but there are, this country is full of Wizards of Oz.
Yeah.
There will be another one, and you have to pull other curtains away and just keep, you know, a bigger picture in view.
Well, would you say that the best way to look at the enlightenment that people will get from this book is, what kind of works does your church do with the money that it collects? If it does good works, you're happy and your money's doing good and you're not scammed. If you're not getting good works, you need to ask questions.
Right, or if your church is telling you to give money so that you yourself can be rich, which is what Joel Osteen and others mm-hmm. do, Creflo Dollar, then something is really wrong. And that is, you know, the prosperity gospel is kind of the logical culmination of all of these trends, because it is just naked worship of wealth for wealth's sake. God is just a means to that end in that scheme. I think figuring out, you know, whether your church is doing good works is great. Before that, I think we need a sort of spiritual economy where churches are not lying about what it means to be rich.
Not lying, and people are awake and recognize that the wealth of their value is in themselves. Well, thank you for your call.
Right. As, again, the Moral Mondays, and there are really positive movements in the Christian world against this grain, and one should look for those as well.
Thank you so much. We've been speaking with Chris Layman, author of The Money Cult. Stay tuned for the Old Mole Variety Hour on this, your community connection, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Urban League of Portland Career Connections Job Fair on Tuesday, April 2nd at 10 a.m. at the Lloyd Center Mall in Portland. The Urban League of Portland Career Connections Job Fair features government, nonprofit, and private sector employers from around the Pacific Northwest who are looking for employees. Again, that's the Urban League Career Connections Job Fair on Tuesday, April 2nd from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the Lloyd Center Mall in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.org.